Welcome to section 363 of Sunstone, Salt Lake City, 2006. Entitled
The Poet Joseph Smith.
The Poet Joseph Smith. Please, admission is by ticket only, and please turn off your noise mechanisms. My name is Jay Zollinger, and I will introduce the speakers. First of all, Colin Douglas became a member of the LDS Church at the age of 16, attended the University of Washington, and took degrees in psychology and English at Brigham Young University. With time out to serve in the Brazilian mission and in Army Intelligence, Vietnam era. He's employed for the Department of Health, now lives in Manhattan with his wife of 37 years, former Linda Wells. He has published poems and articles in Sunstone Dialogue, Kiriantum, and Church magazines. Following him, we will hear from Dennis Clark. Dennis, according to his self-written introduction here, spent 7 years in graduate school at the University of Washington, washing out of a PhD program in English. He left the university with 3 master's degrees, poetry, teaching English, and librarianship. He managed to get work as a librarian in the historical department of the LDS Church, which he left after 2 years when he was told he would never get another promotion there. He spent 26 years and 4 months and a few odd days at the employ of the City of Orem, Utah as a division manager in the Orem Public Library, most of that time wrestling with issues of automation, cataloging, and as a sought in his last 18 years, circulation, and choosing audiobooks as well. It was when a page working in circulation asked him after a discussion of how to better improve circulation, why there was division in the library, and couldn't they just all be along, that he knew he had failed in managing division 2 and retired. He now lives in elegant penury on dwindling retirement funds, types of stock market investments of the kind George Bush thinks all Americans should enjoy in an ownership society. Dennis also has a wife named Valerie and 6 children. And he might admit that acknowledge that Dennis and I were roommates in 1968 in Sulphur Gostry, where we were on a semester abroad. Let's turn the time on this.
Dennis is going to read us a poem first. He's handing out copies because the projection appears to have worked very well.
Thank you. There is such a thing as being too optimistic when this is going to be.
O God, where art thou? And where is the brim that covers thy hiding place? How long shall thy hand be stayed in thine eye, yea, thy pure eye? Behold from the eternal heavens the wrongs of thy people and of thy servants, and thine ear be penetrated with their cries. Yea, how long, O Lord, shall they suffer these wrongs and unlawful oppressions? Pardon me, yea, O Lord, how long shall they suffer these wrongs and unlawful oppressions, before thine heart shall be softened toward them, and thy bowels be moved with compassion toward them? O Lord God Almighty, maker of heaven, earth, and seas, and of all things that in them are, and who control us and subject us to the dark and benign dominion of Sheol, stretch forth thy hand, let thine eye pierce, let thy pavilion be taken up, let thy hiding place no longer be covered, let thine ear be inclined, let thine heart be softened, and thy bowels move with compassion toward us. Let thine anger be kindled against our enemies, and in the fury of thine heart, with thy sword, avenge us of our wrongs. Remember thy suffering saints, O our God, and thy servants will rejoice in thy name forever. My son, peace be unto thy soul. Thine adversity and thine affliction shall be but a small moment, and then if thou endure well, God shall exalt thee on high. Thou shalt triumph over all thy foes. Thy, My friends who stand by thee, they shall hail thee again with warm hearts and friendly hands. Thou art not yet as Job. Thy friends do not contend against thee, neither charge thee with transgression as they did with Job. And they who do charge thee with transgression, their hopes shall be blasted, and their prospects shall melt away as the hoar frost melteth before the burning rays of the rising sun. God hath set his hand and seal to change the times and seasons and to blind their minds, that they may not understand his marvelous works, that he may prove them also, and take them in their own craftiness. Also, the things which they are willing to bring upon others, and love to have others suffer, because their hearts are corrupted, may come upon themselves to the very utmost. That they may be disappointed also, and their hopes may be cut off, and not many years hence, that they and their posterity shall be swept from under heaven, that not one of them is left to stand by the wall. Cursed are all those who shall lift up the heel against my anointed, and cry that they have sinned when they have not sinned before me, but have done that which was meet in mine eyes and which I commanded them. Those who cry transgression do it because they are the servants of sin, and are the children of disobedience themselves. And those who swear falsely against my servants, that they might bring them unto bondage and death, woe unto them, because they have offended my ordinances. They shall be severed from the ordinances of mine house, their basket shall not be full, their houses and barns, their barns shall perish, and they themselves shall be despised by those that have flattered them. They shall not have right to the priesthood, nor their posterity after them from generation to generation. It had been better for them that a millstone had been hanged about their necks, and they drowned in the depths of the depth of the sea. Woe unto all those that discomfort my people and drive and murder and testify against them. The generation of vipers shall not escape the damnation of hell. Behold, mine eyes see and know all their works, and I have reserved swift judgment and season thereof for them all. For there is a time appointed for every man according to his work shall be. The ends of the earth shall inquire after thy name, and fools shall have thee in derision, and hell shall rage against thee. While the pure in heart, the wise and the noble and the virtuous, shall seek counsel and authority and blessings constantly from under thy hand. And thy people shall never be turned against thee by the testimony of traitors. Then all the lands only shall cast thee into trouble, and into bars and walls, thou shalt be had in honor. And but for a small, thy voice shall be more terrible in the midst of thy enemies than the fierce lion, because of thy righteousness. And thy God shall stand by thee forever and ever. If thou art called to pass through tribulation, if thou art in perils among false brethren, if thou art in perils among robbers, if thou art in perils by land or by sea, if thou art accused with all manner of false accusations, if thine enemies fall upon thee, if they tear thee from the society of thy father and mother and brethren and sisters, and if with the drawn sword thy enemies tear thee from the bosom of thy wife and of thine offspring, and thy elder son, although 6 years of age, shall cling to thy garments and shall say, my father, why can't you stay with us? Oh, my father, what are the men going to do with you? And if then he shall be thrust from thee by the sword, and thou be dragged into prison, and thine enemies prowl around thee like wolves for the blood of the lamb. And if thou shouldst be cast into the pit, into the hands of murderers, and the sentence of death passed upon thee, if thou be cast into the deep, if the bellowing surge conspire against thee, if fierce winds become thine enemy, if the heavens gather blackness and all the elements combine to hedge up the way, and above all, the very jaws of hell shall gape open the mouth wide after thee. Know thou, my son, that all these things shall give thee experience, and shall be for thy good. The Son of Man hath descended to the world of all, but that greater than me. Therefore, hold on that way, and the priesthood shall remain with thee. For their bounds are set, they cannot pass. Thy days are known, thy years shall not be numberless. Therefore fear not what men can do, for God shall be with you forever.
We submit for going as a poem authored with a little editorial assistance by Joseph Smith. The original text of this poem is found in a letter dictated by Joseph to a fellow prisoner in Liberty Jail on March 20, 1839, as his people were making their way across northern Missouri toward Illinois, under Governor Wilburn Boggs's extermination order. The letter is addressed to the Church of Latter-day Saints in Quincy, Illinois, and scattered abroad, and to Bishop Partridge in particular, in care of Joseph's wife, Emma. Five passages from that letter have been published in the Doctrine and Covenants of sections 121, 122, and 123. The typescript presentation of the handwritten letter from which the prayer and the Lord's answer are drawn can be found in the personal writings of Joseph Smith, edited by Dean Jesse. The current canonized version is, of course, easily available in the Doctrine and Covenants. The first of these passages, Malmaency 121, verses 1 through 6, is a prayer to the Lord pleading for intercession on behalf of his people. The second, Malmaency 121, verses 7 through 25, and the latter half of the fifth, Malmaency 122, represent the Lord's direct answer to the prophet's prayer. The third passage, Malmaency 121, verses 26 through 32, the fourth, now section 121, verse 33, and the first half of the fifth, Malmaency 121, verses 34 to 46, are spoken as by the prophet to his brethren. Now, that analysis of speaker and audience may be debatable, but I think it is at least defensible, and what I'm interested in at the moment is some results that can be obtained from the Sunnah. On the way to the final poem, as we have presented it, I have amended the original text and the current D&C text in certain ways, which I wish to point out and explain before considering the final text as a poem. Most of these emendations are of punctuation, bringing the text into line with modern practice. Two, however, are too wordy. As Richard L. Bushman describes Joseph's process of composition of the letter in Liberty Jail, quote, "The words came rapidly from his lips without calculated organization. No paragraphs break up the flow, sentences merge. Frequent misplaced and misspelled words show the rush in which the dictation was scribbled down. The preface to the Book of Mormon contains a disclaimer. If they are false, they are the faults of men, implying that even revealed text might reflect the imperfection of its human scribes. Given the circumstances of the composition of the text from which this poem is drawn, it should not be surprising that either Joseph himself or his scribe occasionally lost the train of syntax. In fact, three problems of syntax occurred in the original text and in the current D&C versions of the passages under consideration. The first is in section 121 in verses 11 and 12. And by the way, I've noted versification on the left-hand margin of this text that you have so that you can follow. In the current D&C, "If they do charge thee with transgression, their hope shall be blasted, and their prospects shall melt away as the hoarfrost melted before the burning rays of the rising sun." Semicolon. And also that God had set his hand in a seal to change the times and seasons and to blind their minds that they may not understand his marvelous workings, that he may prove them also and take them in their own craftiness. The "that" clause in the second verse has no proper syntactical relationship to the surrounding text that I can find, and I've discovered no manipulation of punctuation that can give it one. Seeking the semantic intent, I have amended the words, wording as follows: "As the hoarfrost melteth before the rays, burning rays of the rising sun," period, "God has set his hand." The syntax appears to lose its way again between verses 12 and 13. "That he may prove them also and take them in their own craftiness," semicolon, "also because their hearts are corrupted, and the things which they are willing to bring upon others and love to have others suffer may come upon themselves to the very uttermost." Again, seeking semantic intent, I have revised that wording as follows: and take them in their own craftiness, semicolon, also that the things which they are willing to bring upon others, and love to have others suffer, because their hearts are corrupted, may come upon themselves. The third problem occurs in section 122, verse 4, and but for a small woman, and thy voice shall be more terrible. The second and seems superfluous, and I have amended the text to read, and, comma, but for a small moment, comma, thy voice shall be more terrible. I am aware that tampering with the wording of sacred text is serious business, and I want to be clear that in making these emendations, I am not seeking to steady any hearts by proposing changes in the canonized text. I have revised this language merely by way of attempted explication of difficult text. From another point of view, I am here treating Joseph Smith's work as if I were the poetry editor of a magazine to which he had submitted his composition, and I hope that I'm giving this poem more intelligent treatment than some of Emily Dickinson's got from their first editor. I believe the poem speaks well for itself, but a few observations might not be amiss. The language of these combined passages is heightened beyond that of the surrounding text in the original letter, more highly cadenced, more rhetorical, more universal, in that it is more free of references to the mundane details of its historical setting. It can fairly be called rhapsodic, as an ecstatic expression of feeling or enthusiasm. The two combined passages, in fact, coalesce as a highly unified poem in a biblical mode, a fact that is obscured by their present arrangement in the Doctrine and Covenants. It is a bit of dialogue, a tiny drama of cosmic implications, whose characters are a supplicant and his God. The text answers to Barbara Herrnstein Smith's criteria for calling the text a poem. Quote, as soon as we perceive that a verbal sequence has a sustained rhythm, that it is formally structured according to a continuously operating principle of organization, we know that we are in the presence of poetry, end quote. It answers also to the definitions of a poem and of the aesthetic experience proposed by Eliseo Vivas, a philosopher closely associated with the Anglo-American formalism of the last century. Quote, the poem is a linguistic artifact whose function is to organize the primary data of experience that can be exhibited in and through words, end quote. And, quote, an aesthetic experience is an experience of rapt attention which involves the intransitive apprehension of an object's imminent meanings and values and their full presentational immediacy, end quote. And at the risk of pressing your patience, I add a definition given by Cleon Brooks, a central figure in the Anglo-American formalist school, quote, it is in terms of structure that we must describe poetry. The structure meant is a structure of meanings, evaluations, and interpretations. And the principle of unity which informs it seems to be one of balancing and harmonizing connotations, attitudes, and meanings, end quote. The first speech, the supplicant's prayer, is actually capable of standing alone as a complete unified poem. This prayer itself is divided into two parts, the anguished plea for an explanation of God's staying of his hand and the importuning of God to action. There's irony in this speech. The human mortal, mindful of the inadequacy of his own power to defend against his and his people's enemies, of his utter dependency on an all-knowing and all-powerful God, whose knowledge and power he fully acknowledges, cannot yet quite withhold himself from an implied reproach of that same God. There is a further irony and considerable pathos in his attempt to bargain with this apparently unresponsive God, whom he acknowledges as already possessing, in fact as having made all things, by making him the paltry offering of the praise of implicitly acknowledged inferiors. The formal unity of the poem is reinforced by the use of the word pavilion in both sections, that's in verses 1 and 4, and by judicious use of internal rhyme, oppression, compassion, and alliteration, sword, suffering saints, servants, to link key words. But though the prayer can stand alone as a poem, it also functions as a component of a larger unit. The answer is a partial granting of what is requested in the prayer. God comes forth from hiding, not yet to act, but to promise to act. The answer can be read as being directed solely to Joseph Smith, but the prayer was spoken on behalf of the supplicant's whole people, and the answer could as well have been directed to any one of the saints who were struggling across Missouri in March 1839, and indeed to anyone anywhere at any time who suffers persecution for service to his God. The essence of the answer is summarized succinctly in the last two answers, within the last two lines. Fear not what man can do, for God shall be with you forever and ever. But the answer is lengthy and nuanced. It begins with words of calm and assurance. My son, peace be unto thy soul. In 121 and 7. There is no condemnation of the supplicant for his doubts, his implied reproach of God, or the doubtfully Christian craving for vengeance. Rather, there is sympathy for the human plight and the human response to it. But there are then a few words of gentle reproach. Thou art not yet as Job, in verse 103, implying that perhaps the supplicant has been thinking of himself as Job, and reminding the supplicant that God's pure eye, in verse 27, does in fact pierce, verse 4, into the deepest heart of the righteous as well as to that of the wicked. There is further irony in that reproach, because God does not say that in fact things might not yet get worse, as they in fact ultimately did for both Joseph and his people, as they were betrayed by some of their own. There then follows, in verses 11 through 25, a long description of the judgment to be brought upon the persecutors, sufficient to satisfy the human longing for justice and revenge. And embedded in the list of judgments is another expression of tenderness for the persecuted saints. God opens his answer with the words, my son, in verse 7. Then he refers to the saints as my little ones, in verse 19. And a few lines later, he says of the persecutors that it had been better for them that a millstone had been hanged about their necks and they drowned in the depth of the sea. That's in verse 22. A judgment that is spoken elsewhere in Scripture exclusively against those who offend children in the literal sense. But in touching counterpoint, God also speaks of the persecutors as children in verse 17, though as children of disobedience, and this usage resonates with another passage from the works of Joseph Smith, Moses chapter 7, verses 28 through 37, in which God is seen weeping for his disobedient children. That sorrow is not emphasized in this exchange with the supplicant. There is other urgent business at hand at the moment, but the supplicant is obliquely reminded of it. The last line of the answer echoes the last line of the prayer. Thy servants will rejoice in thy name forever, but with emphasis, and ever. For God offers more in return for patience than the supplicant can offer for release and justice. And this echoing promise rounds off the formal unity of the whole. The principal prosodic device employed in this poem is a Hebraic style semantic parallelism with the occasional syntactical parallelism. Ezra Pound dismissed biblical poetry as turgid, and Robert Alter acknowledges in The Art of Biblical Poetry that semantic and syntactical parallelism can result in a mere, quote, jerky progression from one repetition to the other, end quote. But he demonstrates that employed skillfully, it achieves two purposes. Intensification and narrative advancement. Almost all of the subordinate verses, that's Alter's term for the syntactic units that compose lines, in Joseph's poem fall into one or the other category. And the same relationships occur from line to line. Consider the first four lines of the prayer. In each line, each subordinate verse is a semantic elaboration of the preceding one, and there is a movement from the more general to the more concrete and specific, or from the less vivid imagery to the more vivid. The entire passage presents an intensification of language from where art thou to thy bowels be moved by compassion. The first two lines achieve a peculiar intensity by setting the two brief verses of the second line against the ample second verses of the first line, and by closely focusing attention on the striking image of the eye, yea, the pure eye of God. And then in dramatic contrast, the subsequent lines roll forth in a release of dammed-up feeling. And there is rhetorical force in the repetition of key phrases and words. I, yea, the pure eye, and compassion toward them and softened toward them. As the first part of the prayer is about feeling and intensification of feeling, the second part is about action and narrative. As the Almighty God is envisioned as recognizing the plight of his people and rising to defend and avenge them. The first part is all pathetic and desperate plea. The second begins with an invocation of divine might and then erupts into the imperative and even peremptory, stretch forth thine hand, let thine eye pierce, and proceeds through a swift narrative development. The Lord's answer demonstrates the same combination of intensification and narrative development. An especially notable example of the latter is a long passage that begins with, if thou art called to pass through tribulation, verse 5, 122, verse 5, and ends with, if the very jaws of hell shall gape open the mouth wide after thee, in verse 71. A little trouble reading my telling the parentheses from the numbers. And this narrative is skillfully intensified from the general tribulation through the pitiable pleas of the young son to the gaping open of the very jaws of hell. The language of the poem is not metered, but it is cadenced. It relies for rhetorical and incantatory effect on the rise and fall of the whole line, on the contrast, of short lines against long ones, and on syntactical parallelism, particularly in the long series of short lines, like the one beginning with stretch forth thy hand. Joseph once spoke of the visions that roll like an overflowing surge before my mind. There are a roll and surge in the lines of this poem, which I have to say I see as anticipating the lines of Walt Whitman. Joseph's prayer closely parallels Psalm 13 in theme and structure. Psalm 13 begins with the anguished question, how long wilt thou forget me, O Lord, forever? And in its second section, urges the Lord to action. Consider and hear me, O Lord. It ends with the same kind of promise. I will sing unto the Lord because he hath dealt bountifully with me. As to the whole poem, there is obviously precedent for a poetic dialogue in the Song of Solomon and in the Book of Job. And much of the language, beyond the obvious use of the thou forms of the poem, seems recognizably biblical. Nevertheless, this poem offers much more than a mere recycling of old conventions. Compare the first verses of Joseph's prayer with those of Psalm 13, King James Version, the translation with which Joseph was familiar, and I'll read that. How long wilt thou forget me, O Lord, forever? How long wilt thou hide thy face from me? How long shall I take counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart daily? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? Joseph's language is superficially biblical in his use of the thou forms, but he has broken through the somewhat quaint to the modern ear Elizabethan locutions to a more direct modern English. The daintiness of biblical language is replaced by what someone of Joseph's time might have called a manly vigor. Joseph's language anticipates that of modern Bible translations, for example, the New International Version rendition of the first verses of Psalm 13. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? Furthermore, even when Joseph employs vocabulary and phrasing that are used in the Bible, he frequently recombines them and puts them in a new context, giving them new meaning. Consider in verse, I can't even read this myself, 121 verse 19, I think it's 121 verse 19. Severed from the ordinances of mine house. Severed occurs three times in the Old Testament, but never in connection with the temple worship. Ordinances occurs numerous times, and also mine house. But ordinances of mine house, and severed from the ordinances of mine house, are new combinations. And consider the first words of the poem, O God, where art thou? Where art thou occurs once in the Bible, in Genesis 3 and 9, with a breathtaking audacity that heightens the graciousness of the Lord's response. Joseph turns back on the Lord, the very language that the Lord uses to call Adam out of hiding to account for his transgression and to expose Adam's shame. Robert Alter writes that stock imagery is the staple of biblical poetry. He further observes that there is an advantage in working with such conventional figures that, quote, our attention tends to be guided through the metaphoric vehicle to the tenor for which the vehicle is introduced. The creative accomplishment of the biblical poet is often in the intensive development, as Alter says, of the stock imagery. Within the biblical tradition, the only literary tradition with which Joseph was very familiar, the question is to be asked is, what has Joseph done with the conventions? The answer is that he has done quite a lot. He has far surpassed the biblical poets in the boldness with which he reworks old traditions and conventions. He does with the tradition what Ezra Pound says the poet should do, make it new. Thank you.
Sorry about that, while my computer boots up and I stop hitting the stand here. Colin is passing out a handout. Actually, there will be four of them coming down. I urge you to keep them as the order which he hands them out. That's the order which I'll refer to them. And they're going to be a little bit jumbled. I hope we don't get into violation problems for that little tune being on the recording. But you never know these days. So James, you know, off the Warren Sunstone of that. You always want to be careful when you're working on two computers to do something. Especially when you don't know how to network them properly. While I was eating there, I was a far more human error. I left the printout in the paper in the printer home. So I've been reconstructing what I intend to say to you. And I have to apologize for reading off of this computer screen. I don't read well off the screen. I'm going to get this thing open here. There we go. I was going to project some of this on the screen, but I don't think it worked that way. This way my computer starts second guessing. Pass this. One Robert Cohen said, poetry is just the evidence of life. If your life is burning well, poetry is just the ash. He probably didn't have Joseph Smith anymore. Joseph Smith burned brightly in a world lit only by fire, and he left a splendid ash indeed, but Cohen most likely has never considered that ash. That is my task today. On November 27, 1832, Joseph Smith wrote these words to W.W. Phelps. Now, Brother William, if what I have said is true, how careful women have been ought to be, what they will in the last days, lest they are cut short of their expectations, and they that think they stand should fall, because they keep not the Lord's commandments. Whilst you who do the will of the Lord and keep his commandments have need to rejoice with unspeakable joy, for such shall be exalted very high and shall be lifted up in triumph above all the kingdoms of the world. But I must drop this subject at the beginning. O Lord, when will the time come when Brother William, thy servant, and myself behold the day that we may stand together and gaze upon eternal wisdom engraved upon the heavens, or the majesty of our God holdeth up the dark curtain, until we weave around and return to the fullness and satisfaction of our immortal souls. O Lord God, deliver us in thy due time from the little narrow prison, almost as it were, total darkness of paper, pen and ink, and a crooked, broken, scattered, and perfect language. The whole of that text has been published for years in the history of the church. But I think it's far too little known. I like to think that Brigham Young understood why I consider that a poem. He talked about how others had received Joseph in an interview published according to the century of Brigham Young in the New York Herald, circa September 1877. Talking about three things of pain, Brigham Young said. One is to hear saints dwell on Joseph's little shortcomings, as if it made any sort of difference what the idiosyncrasies of the prophet or any other man might be, if he is all right on the main lines. That is all we have any business with. There are some people that can't, that even grace can't call up out of the slew of detail into the largeness of spirit. He talks about some of those. And then goes on, that some of them remembered against Joseph that he went with one suspender, forgot to put on the regulation woven underclothes. They think that if he had had his garments with the holes cut in the breasts and knees and elbows, he would not have got bullet holes in his body. Another thing I don't like to see is so many saints think I'm going to live forever. And among those who don't go so far that no one else will ever make as good a rule of the Mormon people. And then he discusses that a little further. And responding apparently to a query about why he was chosen, was it for his humility? He said, Joseph's words were, "For humility and obedience I have found none like unto our brother Brigham." These words have become for me a kind of test of men. When I see a saint full of himself, his own opinion, his own way, I find myself looking at him with the sad eyes of Joseph. It seems to me that humility and obedience are something very profound and too deep for me. But Joseph Smith was a poet, and poets are not like other men. Their gaze is deeper and reaches the root of the soul. It is like that of the searching eyes of angels. They catch the swift thought of God and reveal it to us, even at the risk of forgetting their underclothes and their suspenders. So what did Brigham Young mean? Did Joseph just want for a competent editor, like, say, me, to put his text into verse in order for his poetry to shine through? It is, of course, easy to take a block of text, break it arbitrarily into short lines, and call it verse. But that does not make the text a poem. We've already heard from Colin some of the qualities that poetry has separate from prose. So what basis do I have, other than my fondness for the text, to call it a poem, let alone to give it a title? I start with a simple fact. Joseph Smith did not write most of the texts connected with him. He dictated them. Most of us don't see any difference between writing and dictating, but we recognize both processes. The linguists understand that speech and writing are different uses of language, and that speech is primary, and writing derivative of speech. We also punctuate our texts following arcane rules that require about this thick to encompass them all. That's the Chicago Manual style for using those of this little poem. The words Joseph Smith spoke were written in longhand by his scribes, who by and large eschewed punctuation, including capitalization. And the ones he wrote in his own hand show that same freedom. This is a transcription of the manuscript from which Little Narrow Creation derives, pardon me. It's this one that's on two sides and looks like prose. The source notes And back down here, give most of the details you need to know. The words inside single and angle brackets and insert in the original manuscript written above the line, and that the words in boldface are written in Joseph Smith's hand. The fact of dictation leads to my second point. While it is possible to recover some information about the voice in which Joseph dictated many of his texts, we don't have a lot of direct evidence about this text because this is transcribed from a file copy. This transcription is not from a dictation, but from a copying over of the dictated letter, which explains why two hands appear in the copy, Frederick G. Williams, when it is not bolded, and Joseph Smith. Both men took part in making the copy. I don't know the circumstance under which that occurred, but it appears from the pagination in square brackets that Williams went from copying the first page of the letter to copying the fourth page, then Smith took up the task. Then Williams to near the end of the fourth page, then someone noticed it had copied pages 2 and 3, so someone crossed out one of them and miscopied. Williams began the corrected copy, and Smith finished it. And again, the handwriting of Joseph Smith is transcribed in folded letters. So you can look at that text and see some of that going on. And Smith finished it except for the postscript. That's why I call the text, that's why the text I call the little mail appeared in prison. Appears here twice. And that is this handout, two parallel texts. And you can see from them on this side the entire crossed out portion I have undone the cross out. So you can see that there were changes made when the second part was recopied by Joseph Smith. The changes appear as a gray highlight here and would appear yellow if I projected this. Those changes indicate either that Joseph, when he copied the first one, didn't copy everything right, or that when he copied the second one, he made some changes. I don't know which, because I can't get my hands on the original of the letter. I don't think it exists, Michael, like the letter. But I do know that this file copy indicates differences in this transcribing in the 8th, 9th line of the first text. There is a phrase, whilst you obey, you do the will of the Lord. If you go to the other text, it says, whilst you do the will of the Lord, and the word to obey is cut out, the phrase obey is cut out. And then added here is the phrase, our cuts short of their expectations, and they didn't think. And towards the bottom, the 5th, 9th, and bottom, and satisfaction is added. I hope that's clear enough. However, I gave you the handout so you can look at it a little bit and think it through after this session if you don't just throw it away. That leaves us in considering this text as a text in the situation those who produced the Book of Mormon critical text. They were, quote, with a view to coming as close as possible to establishing the intention and dictation of Joseph Smith himself. Listing, quoting again, the substantive differences crucial to an establishing of the actual words dictated by Joseph Smith Jr. to his various scribes in 1829. For ease of reading, they've adopted the same sort of layout by phrase, which was recently employed so well by Bradbury Thompson for the Washburn Bible. That scheme for reproducing the rhythms of dictation, that is, layout by phrase, seems to me as good as any other, except that it printed results in capital letters. In using New Jesse's transcription here, I have stuck to what he finds in the manuscripts of upper and lower case, capitalization and punctuation, or more precisely, the lack of capitalization and punctuation. That's why I gave you the whole text so you can look at it. So what scheme did I use to produce the verse in Little Narrow Prison? Well, Frederick Turner, his essay, The Mortal Liar, Poetic Meter, the Brain, and the Plan, suggests a model for poetic meter that he believes to be independent of any specific language. He based his proposal on neurological studies done before 1983 when the essay was published in the August issue of Poetry. Through his assessment of those studies, he concludes that Niebuhr's verse is produced in the unity calls of mind, that in a language like English, which does not use fixed lexical tones, contains between 7 and 17 syllables. This line, quote, nearly always takes from 2 to 4 seconds to recite, with a strong peak and distribution between 2.5 and 3.5 seconds. A caesura will usually divide the lines in the longer part of the longer part of the length. That's the longer part of the length, I think. I think he said that twice. Sometimes, as with Greek and Latin epic dactylic hexameters, the U will be 4 to 6 seconds long, but clearly divided by caesura. Spoken. He views poetry as primarily a poem. I accept that. And so using the term schematic, because it is directly related to speech, and the research is fascinating, about 40 years old, I divided this dictated text into the lines Turner describes. That's the basis of what we read under the heading Little Narrow Prison. But so as not to slight the ultimate view, I'd like to look again at the letter Joseph Smith wrote to William of the Films. I'd like to look at another text separated from the letter, and likewise 7 lines of verse. For this text, however, I'm trying to use something more like the critical text procedure than Turner's. If, as you read along, this begins to sound more like prose to you, take a pencil or pen and mark the point where that begins. You'll be interested in seeing how you feel about that. From what you hear, and try not to cheat either, and read it so that you'll immediately say, there's the prose. Last thing I should tell you is that the little superscript numbers throughout this at the beginning of words refer to versification in Doctrine and Covenants, verse 85, section 85, and the superscript numbers at the end of words are for footnotes. So if you follow along with me. In the essay, the still small voice which whispereth through and curses all things, and oftentimes maketh my bones to quake, while maketh manifest, saying, and it shall come to pass that I, the Lord God, the same one, mighty and strong, holding a scepter of power in his hands, clothed with light for a covering, whose mouth shall utter words, eternal words, while his bowels shall be a fountain of truth to say over the house of God. And do range by lot the inheritance of the saints whose names are found in the names of their fathers and of their children enrolled in the book of the law of God. While that man who was called of God and appointed to put forth his hand to stay the ark of God shall fall by the shaft of death like as a tree that is smitten by the vivid shaft of lightning. And all they who are not found written in the book of remembrance shall find an inheritance in that day. They shall be cut asunder, and their portion shall be accorded to them among unbelievers, where there is wailing and gnashing of teeth. These things I say not of myself, therefore, as the Lord speaketh, he will fulfill. And they who are of the high priesthood, whose names are not found written in the book of the law, whether found apostatized or been cut off out of the church, as well as the lesser priesthood, all the members of that day shall not find an inheritance among the saints of the Most High. Therefore it shall be born unto them as unto the children of the priests, as you will find recorded in the second chapter, the 61st and 2nd verses of Ezra. Now, as you followed along, at what point did you begin to think that there was no more hope in the universe in the days?
About 3/4 of the way down the bottom, where it says, therefore, as the Lord speaketh, it will also rain for the rest of it.
Okay. I think that's a pretty good place to draw the line. There are some rhythmic cadence parts after that. It seems to me that what we're hearing in this is a change from an ecstatic mode of speech to a much more matter of fact mode of speech, and it happens about right there. If you look at the manuscript transcription, then you'll say that, you'll see that after Joseph and Frederick had found their mistake, crossed out the incorrect transcription, and started transcribing. When they transcribed down through verses 4 and 5, and then Joseph Smith picked up the pen at verse 6, Frederick Williams was transcribing at that point. And verse 6 and through the rest of this passage, Joseph Smith transcribed the rest of the letter until he got down to the P.S. and the P.S. is in the hands of Frederick Williams. I don't know the significance of Joseph Smith picking it up specifically at verse 6, what becomes verse 6, essentially. There may be none at all. Before I realized I was breaking the file copy, I thought that essentially Joseph Smith had dictated this letter, reached that point, suddenly been hit by the rhapsodic, yea, thus saith the still small voice which whispered through and pierced all things, and changed. And written that part out himself, as I say, when I realized this was a file out there, I realized that it had nothing to do with the moment of inspiration. So what we have at this point is the possibility that I am making all this up. But if you can hear the difference in those texts, in the movement of the text, in the cadence, in the rhapsodic element, then you may be hearing some of what I'm hearing. I refer you again to the transcription of the entire letter. The lack of punctuation indicates how oral this culture was. They had a more generous approach to speech and less uptight approach to writing it down. Although they did create it up before sending it out before the world. That's because the people who prepared the text for printing were printers and understood some of the conventions of punctuation. The same thing happened with the text of the Book of Mormon. The man who supplied most of the punctuation in the first edition was the printer who set it in type. I believe it's W.S. Gilbert. You know, I'm not sure. Anyway, what happened at this point? That when this letter was dictated, when the letter wouldn't be able to dictate, is that there is much more attention paid to the words and very little attention to the conventions of speech. I have no time to examine the letter from Libby Jail, but you've already heard from Paul Douglas how rich it is. Neither letter was received as revelation, that is, neither the one we just read nor the letter in the jail. Both were later recognized by those who read them that they could be read as revelation. For me, that same process holds for the poetry of it. But I would like to look at a promising excerpt from the text of the letter from Liberty Jail. What I've given you is a direct reproduction of this, the text Jesse, Dean Jesse has transcribed. I ask you to follow along. You will recognize one section here as being canonized as verse 33 of the 121st section. It is here in its context. For some reason, when Orson Pratt put together the 1876 edition of Doctrine and Covenants, he plucked pieces here and there from this letter and broke them together as what we now call section 121, 122, 123. 121 is by far the least coherently extract. 122 and 123 are both coherent extracts from the letter. This is some of what I consider the most interesting imagery, because it's A, a coherent image, and B, it does not rely on anything like the Psalms or the Bible for its approach. This is strictly American poetry based on American experience. Joseph Smith is talking about the Missouri River and the flood. But I may need to say to you, brethren, that ignorance, superstition, and bigotry placing itself where it ought not is oftentimes in the way of the prosperity of this church. Like the torrent of rain from the mountains that floods the most pure and crystal stream of mire and dirt and filthiness and obscures everything that was clear before and all rolls along in one general deluge with fine letters tied, and notwithstanding we are rolling for the time being by the mire of the flood, the next surge for adventure as times roll on may bring us to the fountain, as clear as crystal and as pure as snow. While all the filthiness, floodwood, and rubbish is left and purged out by the way, how long can rolling waters remain impure? What power shall stay the heavens? As when my man stretch forth his puny arm to stop the Missouri River as to create course, or to turn it upstream as to hear the Almighty from pouring down knowledge from heaven upon the heads of the Latter-day Saints. Why is bonds or his murderous party to the Columbian willows upon the shore to catch the flood? Now it seems to me that works much better as an instance of unity and a polemic against the difficulties the church is having. Well, that is verse. Then a woman that is close. You have the text of course. This letter was published, I think, in 1841, the Times and Seasons, which Joseph Smith at that time was editing. So it was published in the initial form under the editorship of Joseph Smith, although I don't think he actually did the text then. But what you have here in the last of the four handouts is the text as more or less as it would look to someone receiving the letter. That is the punctuation, the capitalization, the letters, and everything else we're looking at here is exactly the way the letter would have looked as it came. I submit to you that there is a good deal of richness in Joseph Smith's work beyond what we consider to be its value of scripture. I submit to you further that there are times when we tie ourselves in knots because we take what has the characteristics of poetry and try to read it as prose, especially as theological discourse. I submit to you that Joseph Smith was a rhapsodic, the way Whittingham describes it. He was not careful to put on his suspenders. He was not careful about his underclothes. He was not worried about punctuation. But Joseph Smith was a poet. And poets are not like other men. Their gaze is deeper and reaches the root of the soul. It is like that of the searching eyes of angels. They catch the swift thought of God and reveal it to us. Perhaps we should be reading Joseph Smith as a poet instead of insisting so much that he be read as a theologian. Thank you.